Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Gambling revenues now add up to $1 billion a year in Alberta. From lotto tickets to slot machines, gambling opportunities proliferate every community. Yet very little exists in the way of research on gambling. In March, the University of Lethbridge hosted a conference on the prevention of problem gambling. Among the presenters from across Canada and the United States were three Albertans, Robert Williams, Nadine Nowatzki, and Nadi El-Ghabali. Their pioneer work will help shape the future of gambling in this province. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Recently, I listened to a number of researchers and health professionals speak about their concerns with the explosion in government-sanctioned gambling, not only in Alberta, but around the world. The occasion was a two-day conference at the University of Lethbridge, sponsored by the Alberta Gaming Research Institute. The conference focused on the prevention of problem gambling. What quickly became apparent is that gambling is big business. It's here to stay, and it's embedded in every aspect of our lives. Children learn their letters and numbers playing bingo at school. We finance hospitals with lotteries, and we bet the odds every time we drive in traffic or negotiate a business deal. The question is, where on that gambling continuum do we draw the line between everyday risk assessment, entertainment, and problem gambling? Dr. Robert Williams is a professor in the School of Health Sciences at the University of Lethbridge and coordinator of the Alberta Gaming Research Institute in Lethbridge.
What we try to do in our prevention programs is really to make people smarter gamblers, better risk assessors, because everything you do in life is a risk. It's a calculated risk. And what differentiates good gamblers from problem gamblers is their ability to appropriately calculate those risks and realize that casino gambling is innocuous entertainment if you consider it just entertainment. You cannot make money gambling, and that it's a bad risk of your time and money to do that. In terms of the prevalence of problem gambling, some controversy about that, but roughly between 1 and 3% of the Canadian and Alberta population would be problem gamblers.
Do we know what makes it an addiction? What's going on inside the brain?
Well, I wish we knew more about that, but the best evidence is it's probably activating the same neurochemical pathways as do the other addictions. You know, increased dopaminergic activity in certain reward areas of the brain, because people who gamble and people who have problems gambling get a real thrill, a real high out of the activity. And in the same way that people who use cocaine or people who have a sex addiction or whatever, it's the powerful neurochemical high that you get from that activity that hooks so many people in. And so there's some preliminary evidence. You know, people have done magnetic resonance imaging or positron emission tomography or some of these brain imaging techniques suggest that the pathways involved in the brain for problem gambling are very, very similar, if not identical, to the pathways involved in all other sorts of addictions.
This conference is about the prevention of the addiction to gambling, and there also seems to be an emphasis on youth coming out of some of the presentations. Why youth?
Mostly because they're potentially the most susceptible. It's the first generation that has been exposed to widely available, government-sanctioned gambling. And, I mean, in my day, all you had was Irish sweepstakes tickets, or you could go to Las Vegas and gamble, but it wasn't available. And so even if you had those propensities, you had nothing to, you know, have those propensities cause you to become a problem gambler. And so gambling is everywhere these days. When suddenly something bursts upon the scene and there's not much in terms of prior education that might inoculate that generation, then it's very dangerous.
What is some of the research that you're working on?
There's two or three projects. One that I'll be talking about at this conference is a curriculum that I've been developing with my colleagues at the University of Calgary, Sean Curry, and here at the University of Lethbridge, Robert Wood. And we've been working on a curriculum to prevent problem gambling that is implemented in schools. So we've been working on this last 2 years in Calgary last year. We've looked at the results of that. It's a five-session curriculum intended to educate students about the dangers of gambling, teach them some coping skills and some peer resistance skills, and making them more aware of some of the gambling fallacies that underlie problem gambling so they wouldn't be susceptible to them. It's a very interactive type of engaging, fun type of curriculum that we offer in the Career and Life Management course. So we've got that in Calgary schools, in some rural southern schools as well, and we're testing the effectiveness, and each year we're improving on it because there exists very, very little worldwide in terms of effective problem gambling prevention curriculum. So that's one of the projects we're working on. A second project that I'm doing with a colleague here at University of Lethbridge, Dennis Connolly in the math department, is Dennis teaches introductory stats here at University of Lethbridge, and everyone for the last 2 years who's taken his section of introductory stats has been getting introductory stats with a gambling focus. And so his entire probability section uses gambling examples. And he has labs every week where we actually use craps tables, roulette wheels, etc., so as to demonstrate the odds associated with each of these games. The notion being that gambling is all about probabilities, and so not only is this interesting just to see what sort of impact it would have on their gambling behavior, which is my angle, but it's interesting to see how much more engaging introductory stats is with this sort of way of presenting it. And so now we got people lining up to take his course. My angle in this has been to evaluate. So these students are getting a real heavy-duty intervention about the odds involved in gambling. At the end of it, they all know the odds are stacked against them for everything. Does it change their gambling behavior? And we follow these students up 6 months later, and these are bright individuals. They're university students, and furthermore, they've gotten many, many sessions on the actual odds, and then we're following up 6 months later to see whether their actual gambling has changed at all. Interestingly, no change whatsoever.
Now, why do you think that is?
We are trying to figure that out, but my best guess right now, and this is why it's important to do research, because it's very counterintuitive, my best guess is that it's probably analogous to telling smokers that you're going to get cancer. They already know. Right? Telling smokers about the health risk associated with smoking is no more effective than potentially telling gamblers that the odds are stacked against them with gambling. That sort of informational approach does not actually change behavior. Compared to, say, a prevention program in the schools, which is much more interactive, and we do peer-resistance stuff and coping skills and the dangers of gambling, a more broad-based program where we actually do change behavior. So it's been a very interesting finding.
What's the other project you're working on?
The other project is a very important project from a policy perspective, and that is what percentage of the revenues that governments make from gambling come from addicts. Most governments in North America collect revenues from alcohol and cigarettes. There's some legitimacy in that even if you're a hardcore alcoholic, the most damage you're going to do in terms of monetary damage is $30, $40 a day. There's a lot of social consequences from that. It's not the case with problem gamblers. Problem gamblers can and often do lose their houses, their entire savings, etc., in a very short period of time. Nobody knows what percentage of the $1 billion that came from gaming revenue in Alberta last year came from that 1% or 2% of problem gamblers. And so we are actually following problem gamblers and non-problem gamblers in terms of their day-to-day expenditures over an extended period of time and trying to figure out, at the end of the day, what piece of that pie did that 1% or 2% account for? Current estimates range from as low as 5% to as high as 50%. If it's 50%, then that has some pretty serious policy implications. And some people argue government shouldn't be in the business of arguably exploiting addicted individuals. I don't think it's anywhere close to 50%, but I think it's much closer to maybe 10 or 11 or 12%. A colleague of mine in sociology department, Dr. Robert Wood, and I are doing these projects. We have one in Ontario and one in Alberta that's going to try to figure out what that actual proportion is. So that's the nature of that study.
It seems like gambling is here to stay, though, in terms of being a revenue generator. Where do we go from here?
You're right. The cat's out of the bag, and you can't put it back in. Even if you wanted to, even if you banned gambling tomorrow in Alberta, what would happen is because you've created a culture of gambling, you'd see huge busloads of people going to Saskatchewan and BC and down south. And it would go underground, and it would be illegal. So once you've created a culture, you can't really go back. The future is really in minimizing the harm and maximizing the benefits. There are economic benefits that come out of this. We need to better understand those benefits and better understand how to optimally regulate this industry and how to optimally minimize the harm that's associated with gambling, analogous to what we're doing with alcohol.
What do you see as being the future, the horizon for research?
It's pretty unlimited in that my situation is similar to a lot of people in that I've only been in gambling research about 2 years now. Most of us have research areas from elsewhere because there have been very, very few researchers worldwide whose area has been gambling. Now that it's prevalent, a lot of us are getting into the area, and what we're finding is there's virtually no research. I mean, it's kind of surprising that there's virtually nothing. There's only two published studies ever on prevention of problem gambling programs and see whether they work or not. And both of those studies showed that those particular curriculums didn't work. And so the field is pretty unlimited in virtually every area, like the portion of revenue coming from problem gamblers or internet gambling. It's another project we're involved with. Another colleague of mine, Dr. Gary Nixon, is developing and implementing a awareness program in the prisons, because the prisons are full of people with problems to do with gambling. There is no area of gambling that has been researched well enough. So there's more and more researchers coming into the field, and there's virtually every area is up for grabs in terms of further elucidating what's going on.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Robert Williams, a professor in the School of Health Sciences at the University of Lethbridge and coordinator of the Lethbridge office of the Alberta Gaming Research Institute. Dr. Nadi El-Ghabali is a psychiatrist and addictions counselor with the Foothills Medical Center in Calgary. He's also the chair of the Alberta Gaming Research Institute. At the gambling conference in Lethbridge, he outlined his plans for a long-term study on gambling behavior. The present lack of information makes it difficult to design effective programs to help problem gamblers or to identify people at risk. And with our growing dependence on gambling revenues, I questioned whether prevention was a pipe dream.
I think that in this conference we've had a wonderful review of a variety of prevention programs across the country and from the United States, and they all look extremely promising. I think the point that we have to look at, though, is our expectations from those prevention programs. Are we talking about eliminating any gambling problem in this province? This is where I think it would probably be considered a pipe dream. The goal of prevention programs, I think, is the consensus at the moment, is harm reduction. So how do we optimize the benefits and minimize the limitations, you know, of the availability, of the wider availability of gambling venues? We are minimizing them, we are reducing them, but we cannot stamp them out. And most programs talk about first of all, is the approach to prevention will be a comprehensive one across all gambling venues, opportunities, and all aspects of it, or maybe targeted to some high risk groups. And when we are, for example, in the targeted high risk groups, are we aiming at a reduction, for example, of 10 to 20% in gambling behavior, or 10 to 20% in the consequences of gambling, be it financial, social, eliminating any negative side effect from gambling is going to be an impossibility. Reducing it and actively reducing it is quite possible.
Do we have any idea who's most at risk?
Well, from the studies that have been coming up, the epidemiological studies that have gone, we've been talking about people, for example, who have a family history of their parents were gambling, or they had a problem with addiction. That's certainly a target group that has been identified repeatedly. We also have the fact that just being male is a risk factor. We have also the association with other factors, what we call the usual suspects. And the usual suspects sort around the combination between addiction, delinquency, and sometimes some violence, and problems at school. There's no doubt that's also an important factor. That combination is usually the target groups for prevention interventions in youth. Now, this is for youth. For senior groups, for example, loneliness is a major problem. So again, the risk factors differ with the age group.
What is it that we're really concerned about when it comes down to problem gambling? Is it gambling in casinos, or is it other types of gambling?
I think that gambling has been with us since the beginning of mankind, but something changed about 10 to 15 years ago, and that was what we call the video lottery terminals, the VLTs. And this really changed two things. First of all, the prevalence of problem gambling, but also the rapidity with which people moved from first experimenting with VLTs all the way to problems. Some studies of ADAC, for example, have shown that sometimes from first exposure to VLTs to problem, sometimes it's as low as 6 months. Now, for drugs, for example, like alcohol or whatever, we never see 6 months as being the span from first exposure to life. That has changed the picture.
One of the things that's also been brought up is that the young people who are coming up now, this is the first generation that's really been exposed to, lifelong in their short lives, to gambling. Do you think that that's going to have some sort of impact?
It's not only that. It's also, for example, I was in a movie last week, and we were going through the video arcades, you know, on the way to the movies, and seeing this young generation and the noises and all the reinforcers in a video arcade, I couldn't help but think that this was in fact looking very much like a casino. And this then combined, this predisposition on video arcades combined with much more gambling values and explosion in gambling venues, I would say yes, this is a high-risk group, and specific prevention programs will have to be targeted to that, and approaches will have to be targeted to that.
You're proposing to do a very interesting study that looks at gambling over a long period of time. Could you explain that to me? What is it that you're trying to do?
I think that we're realizing at the moment is that there's been a lot of what we call cross-section studies, which is basically, you know, you have, let's say, a telephone interview across the province for a defined period in time. But there's never been a follow-up in different age groups across time. And what we are looking at is that we are selecting a group of adolescents, group of adults, groups of seniors that would be a representative of the general population, but then there would be a subgroup that would also be at high risk, and following them over 5 years. They do not have to have problems with gambling. They may not even gamble at all. There's not being selected for that. But then we could see their initiation, the exposure, maybe the early problems and consequences as they go on over a span of 5 years. And I think what we feel the benefit of the project is going to be is that we are going to be able, for example, to compare the experience of adolescents at the same time as we are comparing the experience of seniors, at the same time, under the same policies, under the same availability. This has never been done before.
How might you use the results from this?
Oh, I think that this conference is on prevention, and I think the prevention is badly lacking database and specificity, and I believe that this is the kind of study that this is required to, in fact, identify targets for prevention across the various, in the biological area, in the psychological area, in the social area. That's the way to go.
Is there a cure for pathological gambling?
Sure there is. I'm a psychiatrist, and we have a program, and I see pathological gambling is getting better all the time. Now, in terms of cure, as you know, in the field of addiction, one does not talk of cure. One talks about stabilization and hopefully being able to stop the behavior and continue with their lives with the awareness that you remain at risk for many years to come. And you have just to follow this. And one of the ways people sometimes cope with that is by joining a mutual help group, Gambling Anonymous, for example, and to be able to continue and sustain the recovery.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Nadi El-Ghabali, chair of the Alberta Gaming Research Institute. He's also a psychiatrist with the Foothills Addiction Center in Calgary. Some people have figured out that they have a serious problem with gambling and have taken the extraordinary step of getting themselves banned from casinos. This process is called self-exclusion. Nadine Nowatsky is a research associate at the School of Health Sciences at the University of Lethbridge. She's recently finished a study of self-exclusion programs around the world.
It was quite an interesting study because there's very little literature on the subject because self-exclusion is relatively new. The first program that we know of is 1989 in Manitoba and about 1990 in the Netherlands. So they are still new. So my research basically looked at finding out what programs exist around the world. So I was in touch with people mostly by email in South Africa, Australia, various countries in Europe, Sweden, Switzerland, and then looking at the various programs in the United States and in Canada and seeing what's being done, what are the differences between the programs, what seems to be working, etc.
This really is a global problem, isn't it?
It is, and because gambling is expanding, it's becoming more of an issue, and this idea of self-exclusion has got more attention from the media in recent years as you hear more about people joining this program.
Are all the programs the same?
No, not at all. And that's one of the problems, is that there's very little standardization or uniformity. In Canada, there's at least uniformity within each of the provinces. But in the United States, for example, there's a lot of differences in the way that they are administered, the length of the self-exclusion contract, where you can sign up for it, all those kinds of issues. So there's very little uniformity in the programs.
Do they work?
Do they work? That is the big burning question. They do seem to work for a minority of people. If we look at the number of problem gamblers, if we look at the data from prevalence studies, the number of problem gamblers who sign up for these programs, it's minuscule. We're looking at maybe 0.4 to 1.5% of problem gamblers are actually reached by this program. And those who do sign up, we know that a lot of them are able to re-enter the casino without being detected. So that's a huge problem. So there's a lot that needs to be done to improve the programs if they're going to work for problem gamblers.
Are there any successes anywhere? Is any country doing it better than others?
Well, I consistently plug the Netherlands. Holland Casino has, I believe, 11 casinos throughout the Netherlands, and they have a system, a computerized registration system. Now, in Europe, it's very different from in North America. To enter a casino, you often have to be a member. So you have to actually have a card or a driver's license to gain admittance to the casino. So playing on top of that, they've developed a system where if you are self-excluded, you have that in the computer so that when you try to enter the casino, you're immediately detected by the computer system. So they have a very high rate of success in the Netherlands, and they have a very proactive approach to responsible gaming, very different from what we have in North America. The government has a much larger role in the regulation of gambling in Europe.
Now, that's a term I've heard over and over today, responsible gaming. Can we really have that?
I think we can, but it's something that has to be negotiated. We have to think about the role that we want the government to play in our lives, the issue of invasions on our privacy, this whole talk about Big Brother, all these cards that we need for all the things in our lives like the bank and getting gas and groceries, etc. People are resisting that. But if we look at what's happening in Europe with the way governments have a proactive approach and actually take a very due-care approach to gaming, I think that things could change for the better in Canada as well.
Now, you said that people who have signed up for this self-exclusion, they recognize that they have a problem, and yet they still go back and they get through. Why aren't the casinos being more diligent?
Okay, there's a couple of comments related to that question. The first is that casino exclusion is primarily the responsibility of security personnel in the casinos. So in other words, the security personnel are responsible for being familiar with the photographs of self-excluded individuals. Now, as this program increases in popularity and more people sign up, that means security personnel could be responsible for looking out for anywhere from 800 to 1,000 people and being able to recognize them. So it's not a very efficient process, because how can one individual be able to spot and recognize hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of these people? So that's the one issue. The other issue is that even if the person is able to exclude themselves from casinos, they're not excluded from going to play VLTs, the video lotto terminals, from going to play bingo, or from any of those other gambling opportunities that are legal or illegal, or internet gambling. So there's a number of issues there.
Now that you've had a chance to do this comparison and see what's going on around the world, what would you recommend? What do you think we have to do?
Well, I think, first of all, we need to have more discussions about self-exclusion and have feedback from people who are in the treatment business, who are practitioners or clinicians. We need to get the industry involved, and we need to get the government involved. So that's the first step, is to get people talking about what they think might work. Some of the recommendations that I would make are making sure that we're promoting these programs, letting people know that they're available, making sure we have standardization within each of the jurisdictions, making sure that we're enforcing it. If we're telling the person that we're going to keep them out, let's do that, and perhaps computerized registration is a good way to do that. So those are just some of the ideas, making sure that we have a pathway for people who are interested in this program to treatment, so that they know that treatment is available and they have the option of choosing treatment.
Thank you very much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Nadine Nowotsky, a research associate at the School of Health Sciences at the University of Lethbridge. She presented her findings at the recent conference on the prevention of problem gambling in Lethbridge. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during the program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the University of Lethbridge, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, the Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, the Alberta Ingenuity Fund, Capital Region Innovation Centre, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, True North Energy, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Research Council, ICOR, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.